Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In the Garden State Parkway murders, true crime writer and attorney Christian Barth dives into the harrowing story of the unsolved murders of Elizabeth Perry and Susan Davis. College friends, the two women were brutally knifed to death and their bodies left off the parkway in the early hours of May 30, 1969. Among the numerous suspects Barth identifies are infamous serial killers Ted Bundy and Gerald Eugene Stano, who were living within an hour's drive from where the murder scene at the time they occurred. The killers also resided next to one another on Florida's death row and indirectly confessed to the double homicide. A culmination of more than 9 years of research, Barth's book is compiled from multiple sources, including interviews with retired New Jersey State Police detectives, law enforcement officials from other jurisdictions, federal agents, possible witnesses, victim family members, as well as information gathered from FBI case files, letters, journals, libraries, newspaper articles, and university archives. In scintillating detail, Barth presents the case, including previously undisclosed information surrounding these brutal murders, as well as an examination of recent technological advances in crime scene analysis and FBI serial killer profiling that could help identify the killer. When all is said and done, the reader is asked to consider, why hasn't this cold case been solved? The book that we're featuring this evening is The Garden State Parkway Murders, a Cold Case Mystery, with my special guest, attorney and author, Christian Barth. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Christian Barth.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. An incredible case. Let's get to right away. Tell us a little bit about your interest in this case and how you came about to be the author. And in that, tell us about your book, The Origins of Infamy.
Okay, so it goes back to a childhood memory back in about, I'd say I was 12, 13, maybe 14. As a boy, even leading up to that point, we had always traveled to the Jersey Shore. We had relatives down there, and we used to vacation every summer for about 2 weeks in a town called Stone Harbor, which is in Cape May County. To get to Stone Harbor, you would travel, obviously, down the Garden State Parkway. On one of these trips north, on the parkway, or on several of these trips north, I would always, as a kid, look out into the woods as we drive past them. I grew up in a town called Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which is strictly suburban, street lights, neighborhoods, things along those lines. There really weren't any woods. So on these trips north, I would always look into the woods, and I was interrupted from one of these reveries at one time from my mother saying to my father, who was driving, I was in the back seat. She said they never found out who killed those girls, did they? And it was just fascinating to me. Perhaps it was the mention of this case in the conjunction of me looking outside at the woods, and my ears perked up, and I said, what case? And I'd learned the briefest of details, and I remember my father saying, yeah, for a while they had a trailer in the woods because the killer always returned to the scene of the crime. Now, that part of it being in the woods wasn't an accurate recollection of it, but nevertheless, that memory just stayed with me for a few minutes. Got buried in my subconscious until 1993, when I had read on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer a story by writer Larry Kelly that Ted Bundy had been in the area, and his biographer, a guy named Mr. Larson had, in fact, written The Deliberate Stranger, which became the movie starring Mark Harmon. He was of the opinion that Ted Bundy was in the area at the time and had, in fact, confessed to the murders based upon several remarks he had made to a psychologist named Art Norman in 1986 while on death row, and later on the eve of his execution, to Dr. Dorothy Lewis. So when about year 2000 or 2001, I had gotten in my mind to become a writer. And I had taken a class at Rutgers University, and a short story was a requirement, and I didn't have an idea. And for some reason, it just came into my head, wow, that was an interesting story. So I fictionalized the story into a short story that was published soon thereafter. I think it was called The Smiling Knife, and it was a loosely based interpretation of the story. And from there, I said, well, you know what, I'm really into this fiction writing. I was really, really discovering it, and writers that influenced me, like William Styron and guys like that. I just decided to write a book fictionalizing the Parkway murders, told entirely from Ted Bundy's perspective, for beginning in death row and then going back his time in Seattle. Obviously, all this taking place in 1969, leading up to the murders. Bundy was in New York City. He had lived in Philadelphia in the spring of '69. Staying with an aunt. So I really coalesced all this research that I did into a book called The Oranges of Infamy. I went to New York City to the public library, went to archives, just got a real feel for, you know, the pornography and those things that Bundy attributed as influences, in his motive to kill. I believe he called it, you know, the entity that was formed in New York City. That, of course, was referenced later by him, not only to Hugh Ainsworth and Steve Michaud in conversations with a killer, but at latter times as well. So these are when I say latter times, he had mentioned this to Dr. Dorothy Lewis and Art Norman in discussing, after he went to New York City, he went to the Jersey Shore. He never mentioned the Jersey Shore component to Ainsworth or Michaud, so that was fascinating, but he did mention it to these two other psychologists. So that's how it began, and I was just fascinated by the case from that point forward, and that's what gave rise to the Oranges of Infamy.
Now, with this book, you talk about the setting is Ocean City. So tell us about Ocean City, and tell us about Susan Margaret Davis and Elizabeth Perry.
Okay, so Ocean City began, its beginnings were in the late 1800s. A trio of Methodist ministers had founded it, as they call it, like a seaside oasis, a very Christian, virtuous place. There is no drinking there. The Blue Laws have been in effect since its founding. There's a tabernacle there. It's always had a very Methodist influence. Toward the late 1960s, the composite had started to change in a not so great way. You had, it's funny what the writers of the Ocean City Sentinel, the newspaper down there, and the other papers had called, quote unquote, the undesirable element, which I thought was a funny way of looking at it, started to go there. And they would stay at the houses, the young people, the college kids, and they would leave from there and go to the bars at Summers Point, which is right across the bridge, which is sort of the bacchanalia, you know, of the Jersey Shore. Then you had bars like Tony Mart's, Bay Shores, and whatnot that were there. Actually, Tony Mart's is where, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie, it's a cult classic, Eddie and the Cruisers with Tom Berenger. It was filmed there before it was torn down. So you had that real distinct difference between the two places. So Susan and Elizabeth were both 19, and they had one had graduated from Monticello College, which is a girls' school in Illinois, no longer there. And they were friends, and they decided to take a trip down to the Jersey Shore. And they wound up staying at one of the many rooming houses that were down there at the time. affordable rooming houses for kids who would stay and go to the beach and, again, go to Summers Point at night. So they were there for 3 days. They stayed at a rooming house. Susan, by the way, was from Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Elizabeth was from Minnesota. So they went and became friends at Monticello, went to the Jersey Shore, stayed there, and by all accounts, you know, they didn't meet a lot of people. They were suntanning. These weren't real party girls, so to speak. They were very nice girls from very fine families. They had gone there, stayed for 3 days, and on the morning of May 30th at about 4:30 a.m., they had gotten up to leave, spoke with their landlord, an elderly gentleman named Walter Seiden, told him they were leaving, and they took off. He saw them, you know, leave in their car. Susan was driving a 1966 Marina Blue Chevrolet convertible. They left there, and then they were seen at the Summers Point Diner, about, again, a mile and a half away over the bridge in Summers Point. Now, to understand the thing with Summers Point Diner, all these bars that I referenced earlier would get out at 2:30 in the morning. There were two all-night bars as well that would feed into every kid after the bars closed would just stagger on over to the Summers Point Diner, which is the only place open all night back then, 24/7. I talked to Mr. McGill, the owner of the establishment back then. He said literally there was a standing line there all day long, all night long, with kids going in.
Right.
So that's how they wound up being in Susan and Elizabeth wound up getting to the point. And from there, of course, they drove off, and the murders occurred about 2 miles away.
Now, they are expected by, Susan is expected by the parents, Wesley Davis Sr. and his wife, Marjorie. So this, you say that tell us how long this ride is supposed to be, and when do the parents get a sense of urgency and panic, and what do they do as a result?
Okay, so they, with respect to the parents, they were, Susan and Elizabeth, were going, that the plan was after they left the boarding house in Ocean City, they were going to go to directly home to Susan's parents' house in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, specifically, which is a suburb of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the state capital. And they were supposed to join Susan's parents for a trip down to Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, to see Susan's older brother graduate that weekend. So by mid-morning, when the kids didn't appear at the house, immediately Mr. Davis started to grow concerned, because it just wasn't like Susan. She wasn't flighty. She always told them where she was going to be. And by about noon, they still hadn't heard anything. And as the day went on, they grew more and more concerned because they hadn't heard anything. They began contacting friends who hadn't heard from the two girls. They contacted Elizabeth's parents. No one heard anything. And by the next day, they started to get a little more panicky. And Mr. Davis went ahead and contacted a man who was then the Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania, who I interviewed in the book, and Mr. Sennett. And Mr. Sennett said, look, I'll try to do what I can. But at this point, they were really just, because in the late 1960s and early 1970s, missing persons reports were rather common. Kids were basically would go off for a few days, and there wasn't really, no alarm bells went off. But as time went on, Dan, over that weekend, it became very apparent that something had gone wrong. In fact, both fathers had said instinctively something had gone wrong. So they wound up renting a helicopter and done a sweep over the woods to see if they could find any signs of wreckage. So that's how the Davis, Mr. Davis, had some of the investigation began into their disappearance.
You, meanwhile, talk about two New Jersey State Troopers that are assigned early morning patrol in the southern corner of Parkway on Memorial Day weekend, 1969. This is Troopers James Dunbar. He's 24 years old, and later, John Stair. Tell us about this patrol on Memorial Day weekend.
Okay, so Trooper Dunbar and Troopers Dunbar and Sturr were both stationed out of the Avalon, New Jersey State Police Barracks. Their route was a 24-mile loop that started there, went down along the parkway, and back. So Mr. Dunbar had gone and you know, had the first shift early in the morning and said he didn't see anything. The next person was Trooper Sturr. Trooper Sturr went along and saw the girl's car abandoned on the side of the road, or what he didn't know was that their car at that time was actually Susan's convertible. He pulled over. It was near mile marker 31.9 on the parkway, milepost 31.9. He pulled over, and he didn't see anything that would suggest that there was any foul play. Susan's straw purse was located downstairs. I'm sorry, not downstairs. In the car itself, there was no indication, again, that the car had skidded off the side of the road, any mechanical breakdown. He presumed it was abandoned. He then called in to both, I guess it was because it was a Pennsylvania tag, he called into the Pennsylvania Division of Motor Vehicles, reported the tag number, and the person there mistakenly relayed back that it belonged to another person. So he presumed it was abandoned. He had no idea at the point at that point, Dan, that in fact the fathers, you know, had there was these missing girls. So he went ahead and had it towed. The place called Blazer's Garage, no longer in existence. They came along and they had the car towed, and it remained there at this guy's garage, Blazer's Garage in Northfield, not too far away, for 3 days. And at this point, the parents had done the helicopter, and it was, you know, in the newspapers. The New York Times had reported that these two girls were missing. So when Trooper Sturr comes back from a fishing vacation that weekend, he sees, you know, the teletypes, the missing persons, and he puts two and two together. And that's when he says, oh, you know, I went over there and it was these girls. And in fact, who it was. And that's when the investigation began. But it was, I don't want to say it was an oversight, but I don't know there was anything really Trooper Sturr could have done. But you know, maybe he should have investigated into the woods right there. But do we know that the girls were dead at the time that he came by? The coroner had indicated that the times of death was about 45 minutes within the time they had left the diner, which was about 6 a.m., give or take. So then he drove by and saw the car at about 8 a.m., so the crime would have taken point at that place. But that's how they initially discovered Susan's car on the side of the road.
Now, once they do that, they undertake a search, and what do they find in that search?
Okay, so they immediately dispatched members of the Highway Authority, the Garden State Parkway, which is under the aegis of the New Jersey, I think, Turnpike Authority, and a bunch of local workers on hands and knees did a grid search. It wasn't – they literally 15 minutes into the search, a guy named Elwood Font literally stumbled across the bodies. They were covered in leaves. One of the women had been found completely nude. The other was dressed except for her shoes. And this is where they this is essentially how they found the bodies. And as far as, you know, what was found there was no evidence – really that it had taken place anywhere other than there. In other words, with the bodies dumped, et cetera, et cetera. They simply found them there, and they were concealed and obviously had been stabbed to death. So,
in terms of motive for this crime and evidence of robbery, what's the situation there that police find?
Fascinating. There was no evidence of robbery. Susan's purse, again, was left in the car. Elizabeth's was found nearby her, and there were a few dollar bills in there. I had found, again, through research, that Elizabeth actually had on her hands jewelry, some rather expensive heirlooms containing diamonds and so forth, and charm bracelets. So you'd think if the person's motive was robbery, why wouldn't they have taken those things? But they weren't. They were left there. As far as motive, it's just difficult to discern from that what his motive was based upon him not taking anything and merely killing him, not robbing them, and basically fleeing the scene.
What about the three-day delay in basically being able to find those bodies? What did it do in terms of decomposition, in terms of the coroner's mode of death, basically?
The thing was, I had spoken with a retired detective named John Dibble. John had been to the crime scene. He didn't have jurisdiction. Jurisdiction resided with the New Jersey State Police because it was found alongside the parkway. And John had indicated to me that there was, just because it was a very hot weekend, it was really an accelerated rate of decomposition with the bodies. So they were never able, because of that, to find whether or not either of the girls had been sexually assaulted. So the three-day lag really contributed to sort of the mystery as to what exactly happened at the scene. So
they also, through their analysis and investigation, they also saw that nothing indicated that the vehicle had been forced off the road. The gas tank was 3/4 full and the battery was charged. They hadn't pulled over due to a technical problem. In terms of any signs of struggle, what did it seem like, and what was their early hypothesis in terms of how they came to their demise on that roadside?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, Dan. We just don't know, because there were no signs. I mean, there was the initially police considered, well, you know, was it a hitchhiker that they had that pulled them over? Was the car abandoned? Obviously, the police determined that there was no mechanical problems. It hadn't run out of gas. So we really don't know what exactly caused them to pull over in the first place, nor do we know what caused this person to go ahead and kill them in the manner that they did at that time of the day. Now, sunrise, according to my research, was at 5:29 a.m., so what you have to recognize, because this occurred at peak sunlight, you know, not peak sunlight hours, but when there was light at that time of the day, that sort of adds to the whole mystery of it. Why would a person, if in fact they were pulled over to the side of the road, why would he do this in pure daylight and commit this act so close to the side of the road with these people? And it's presumably the guy was a stranger. There were no reports that they had met anyone, anyone that was seen, with whom they may have had some sort of conflict. There was nothing like that. So all these factors contribute to the mystery of the case and fascination that I had with it.
This case, as you write, this makes national attention. You got the likes of Walter Cronkite reporting on CBS Evening News. So this is big. How do the state police proceed with this investigation?
Well, they initially appoint, obviously, several detectives. They decide that the Absecon State Police Barracks, which has since that time shut down and become an office building of sorts, that's going to be the nerve center. The troop headquarters for this troop was in Hamilton, not too far from the murder location as well. But because a lot of the troopers live near Absecon, and that's where it took place, that was decided to be the nerve center. And what they did was completely dismantle, got the interior of the place and put in bunks and so forth, and that's where everyone reported to. And it became a 24/7 investigation in the first days. The state police had interviewed, hundreds of hundreds. This grew to, a few thousand of every young man they could. They worked around the clock to find out anything they could. They visited the bars, Summers Point. They interviewed people that had stayed at the boarding house with the girls. They did everything they possibly could to try to find out who did this. But it always comes back to that three-day lag between the time of the discovery of their bodies and when they had broken down on the side of the road, which really contributed to the delay and the problems with the investigation by the time that police learned and finding anything.
Tell us about Albert Hickey Jr. and what does he have to say, the security guard?
Okay, Albert Hickey was a part-time security guard with the Summers Point Police Department. Back then, because of the number of young people that were there that I discussed earlier, the proximity to the Bay Avenue bars like Tony Mart's and Bay Shores and the Anchorage Tavern and the From Dunes Till Dawn, which was another place out in Longport. Because of that, they had to hire all these part-time security guards. So Albert Hickey was one of them. Albert Hickey was working at the diner, and he said that on that morning, around the time of the murders, he saw a blue convertible stop at the Circle and pick up a hitchhiker he said was about 5'9" and was carrying a what looked like a flight bag. Apparently, a long time ago, TWA used to give you a flight bag. For whatever reasons, when you took a flight. And he said that's what it reminded him of, sort of a satchel. He was wearing a yellow turtleneck or shirt, got into the car, and sped, left thereafter. I did interview Albert at length. He was also, in addition to being a part-time security, he was an Associated Press photographer. And he was actually at the I think it was an Absecon and covering the matter for the Associated Press when he had learned of the lag in time or something along those lines. But he then told the police what he had remembered of what happened. And he was actually brought in to be questioned as well as to what he knew. But he was the first person, Albert, to identify a person who appeared to be getting into a car. Two girls that fit the description of Susan and Elizabeth, and he identified the person as wearing a yellow shirt. From that point forward, the media just really attached themselves to his testimony and what he saw, and from that point forward, they began their search for anyone who was wearing a yellow shirt. So that was Albert's real contribution to it early on.
What did police find in their search around the crime scene, and what did they hold back from the media and the public in terms of information regarding that evidence?
What they found at the crime scene was a watch. That was the most important thing, a watch. It was called a Belfort Sea Diver, which was a model manufactured by the Bentrooms Company out of Ridgefield, Connecticut. It was a diver's watch. They initially held back the existence of this dive watch from the newspapers. It was that and Susan's sunglasses, and tried to find out, if they could find anyone wearing a dive watch. In fact, that comprised a lot of their questioning. As to the people they didn't put in the paper yet at this point, who had the dive watch, was anyone wearing a watch, et cetera, et cetera. Another thing they had withheld was the jewelry that Elizabeth had been wearing. And there was another, method of restraint that they had, you'd really probably keep that for the book, the readers of the book, that they had withheld as well, which obviously I indicate so forth in the book. That was found as well, and that they had held back from the press. The reason they do these things, oftentimes, the holdbacks, is because once it gets out into the papers that there are these murders, you get a lot of publicity seekers and psychologically unbalanced individuals who will go to police and give false confessions, and they use these holdbacks to sort of ferret out the truth tellers from the people that are seeking publicity and want to be known as a killer and so forth. It's pretty twisted, but that's why.
Sure. Of course, they go through and talk to the landlord. They talk to boarders at this place on Ocean City. They talk to the boys came forward that had. The diner lunch or the breakfast with the girls. All of these people came forward, were cooperative. the state police really liked polygraphing, and they did investigate and ask for polygraphs from numerous people in this investigation, didn't they?
That's correct. Everyone, you know, who willingly submitted to a polygraph, you know, that they would. And I actually got a call from a guy who was a college professor nowadays, and he said, you know, just because he was wearing a watch, someone called the police and said he had this watch. They showed up. I think he was at an ROTC gathering of sorts, and the police literally showed up and pulled him out of the line and, you know, made him take the test and so forth. So they didn't mess around back then. They would show up, and they were, because of the intense pressure to find these girls and the time component, they would show up and just interview several young men, as I said, into the thousands to try to find out if they knew anything about the case.
Now, you write that the state police really only have this description from Hickey, this 5'9", shaggy hair, yellow top, may have been wearing a diver wristwatch, because they did release that eventually, didn't they? That public information became public?
Yes.
But he was uncertain of the color of the convertible. What other information were the police conflicted with in terms of timeline for this story here, for them to be certain about Albert Hickey's testimony?
Well, there were some witnesses, but some people did come forth after what was publicly disclosed about Hickey's account and said there was another car at the time. Basically, whatever Albert said he saw, the police said there may have been another convertible at the same time. Essentially, although they obviously gave great weight to what he said, they were able to exclude, in their opinion, what they saw, at least at the time, as being the same convertible driven by Susan Elizabeth due to the timeline. I think he said he saw it at around 4:30, but they were seen eating at the diner at about 5:30, so the time didn't really jibe with what he had seen. But the yellow shirt would obviously, as you know, come to fruition as a substantial piece of evidence later on down the road as far as identifying someone else.
You talk about the state police stopping people. They think that that frequently use the parkway, see if they've seen anything, and they stopped 8 people who said they saw the light blue convertible near the scene at 6:30. One witness said another car model, and the police seemed to believe this account. What was this vehicle, and what was its color, and what did they think? What was its significance to this story?
Okay, so following Albert Hickey's account, what next became apparent is that there were a number of witnesses that did drive by and saw Susan's abandoned convertible on the side of the road around, you know, within a few hours span of the time of the murders. They also mentioned seeing what was first reported as a maroon Mustang, which was corrected later on to reflect it was actually a tan Mustang parked, I want to get this, about 100 yards, give or take, behind Susan's convertible. And that was the car. So that, again, once this became public, you know, that there's a maroon convertible, 3 boys came down there from Pennsylvania. They actually traveled down to Absecon, where the barracks was, and one of the boys voluntarily gave a statement with his father and said, you know, it was us. We were actually driving north from Wildwood, had run out of gas, and decided to park on the side of the road and go to sleep for a few hours. And then, you know, the plan was they would wake up and go and get gas or hitchhike, whatever the case may be. What's fascinating is when they woke up, they saw the car there, but they said that when they originally pulled over the side of the road, Susan and Elizabeth's car wasn't there. And it was determined that the girls were murdered at the time these 3 young men were sleeping. which I found just incredible, because how the two girls get violently murdered about 50 yards away in the woods from where these boys were without hearing anything. I mean, several years ago, a friend of mine and I decided to conduct a test, and he was standing about 100 yards away, and I said, you know, just scream for me and tell me if you can hear this. And I did. Granted, I hadn't been drinking at the time. But it just, you know, you think about the times in your youth when you had had a few too many beers and you, you know, fallen asleep, whatever the case may be. You think there's something in your makeup that alerts you, or a sixth sense, something so tragic as that. But that always amazed me, and does so to this day, how those three guys were able to sleep through this. And that lends itself, of course, to various theories as to how these girls were brought into the woods in the first place. You know, were they, was a gun raised upon them? Obviously, they didn't scream initially. They would have gone in. One of the detectives that I spoke with years later said he was of the opinion that they were, and he used the term, compliant in going into the woods. And obviously, you know, and I researched other things, Dan, you know, about, you know, does a person get, can he be frozen, he or she be frozen into submission, be so scared that you can't scream. And that is, that's a condition. That is definitely, you know, that can happen. And maybe that's what happened here, but it's always struck me as odd that these three boys didn't hear anything. However, the other two boys were interviewed, and the one submitted to a second round of questioning, the one that initially went down from Pennsylvania to the Absecon station, all three of them passed lie detector tests, aren't considered suspects and were released.
Now, you talk about the trooper finally finding a yellow turtleneck.
There wasn't a trooper that found it. It was maybe one of the searchers had found a yellow turtleneck and a girdle. I haven't heard that term in forever. And they were brought to the station. It was analyzed, and it was determined not to be connected to a historic story. The area where these girls were found is quite interesting. It's known to be right by what's called the Cove. So on the surface, as you're driving past it, it's very rural, the particular section. Okay, there are no homes back. There are now, way back, but there weren't at the time. It was adjacent to a pig farm. So, it was called a trysting place as well. A lot of kids from local mainland high school would party there. And nearby was a beach along the Patcon Creek called the Cove, where locals would party. So it was definitely an area that was known to locals, but there weren't any entrances along the side of the road, like trail maps or anything like that. It wasn't a public park. So there were people that had been back there, but as far as that turtleneck is concerned, yeah, they did initially find that. And in doing so, and in testing that, obviously didn't discount Albert Hickey's theory, which lends itself to the fact that they were taking anything and considering at that point that they had so little evidence.
You, for the writer, have the fact of Susan's funeral, and very dramatic in that a witness says that you could never forget the mother screaming at the front of the church, Davis family. So also after this, shortly after this, or somewhat after this, the Philadelphia Police Department received a tip from a store clerk in a clothing store. What does this clerk say he overheard and saw, and what did the police do?
So the clerk in a clothing store on 14th Street north of Market, you have to understand about this area, it's long since been gentrified. It's a sort of an interesting little area. I wouldn't want to say it was seedy. It was very funky, sort of a Greenwich Village late 60s feel to it. A couple of, they called it a red light district, but it wasn't like Times Square, in other words. So these two women, at this point, you have to remember, this is 5 days after the bodies were found, and it's in just the really the
the heady days of the investigation. So these two girls are in a clothing store on Market Street, and they say that they overhear, or they're talking to some guy who comes in there wearing a yellow t-shirt, a yellow shirt, who is wearing a yellow turtleneck. Now, the clerk of the store overhears the man saying to them, you know, words to the effect of, I was down there at the beach when that happened. I guess the girls were talking about the Ocean City, the case, the murders, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the clerk overhearing this remembers that he had read in the paper of Albert Hickey's account of seeing allegedly a guy in a yellow turtleneck getting into the car with the flight bag with two girls driving a convertible on the morning of the murders. He contacts the Philadelphia Police Department, who thereafter proceed to find this particular, what they called as 18-year-old hippie type, at the bus station nearby, and brought him in for a round of questioning.
What was Thomas's history, and what happens in the polygraph?
Again, they reference him as the quote-unquote 18-year-old hippie type. The polygraph was conducted by the Philadelphia Police Department, I guess their homicide department. They had him in there without a lawyer for about a couple of hours, and they, according to the newspaper and an unpublished memo that I had discovered, he gave what they called quote-unquote fuzzy answers. In other words, my understanding of that they weren't able to really discern that he was telling the truth, but nor could they say he had any knowledge. There's always been a vast gray area as to, you know, what those tests revealed, but obviously there was enough there in their interpretation to immediately contact, and I guess they would have done it anyway because they didn't have jurisdiction, the New Jersey State Police. So at about midnight, Detective George Dix, who I interviewed several times, he got a call while he was eating dinner at his home in Atlantic County, New Jersey, from, I think it was Mario Patera, who was the captain of the state police at the time, saying, look, you got to get over to Philadelphia. We may have the guy. And I want to correct what I just said. He may have been, I think he was either at home or he was at the Turnersville, New Jersey barracks, interviewing the three boys found in the tan Mustang. It was, I think, right after them when he went over. They actually drove Mario Patera's car. He and Mr. Patterson, Detective Patterson, went over and met with the 18-year-old suspect, and he consented to be interviewed, and it went all night long. It was just a crazy, crazy, you know, time. They interviewed him at length, and they just obviously were really pushing to get, if they're able to. He was obviously, did he know that at the time, free to leave any time, but he did not. He chose to, you know, agree to the questioning and so forth. And the fascinating aspect of this is, he was, I guess there was a 24-hour, a 12-hour hold, but under Pennsylvania law, you either had to charge a suspect or let him go. So there was another detective there named Donald Patterson, who coincidentally, he was the head of the Philadelphia Major Crimes Unit at the time. He later became Pennsylvania Inspector General. He approached the other Donald Patterson. By the way, the Philadelphia Donald Patterson, excuse me, was African-American, and Mr. Patterson of the New Jersey State Police was Caucasian. So Detective Patterson and George Dix were informed by this Mr. Patterson, look, you have to let these guys go, or let this kid go or charge him. And they're outside in front of the barracks, and Mr. Patterson was saying he actually had an argument with Dix, because Dix was convinced, look, you know, we got to keep this going. And Patterson's like, look, we have nothing on this kid. You know, I'm not buying it, but this kid knows anything about the case. So they say he's free to go, but they ask him, look, would you be willing to accompany us down to New Jersey, to submit to another lie detector test and more questioning? And he agrees. So yeah, he gets into a car with these two, And they're driving across the, it was either the Delaware, I think it was the Ben Franklin Bridge, to go into New Jersey and then proceed from there to a barracks. And they don't have the money to get over the bridge. It's like a 50-cent charge toll, whatever it was. So the kid, the 18-year-old, proceeds to take 50 cents out of his pocket and gives them the money to do it. So they then go from there after to the Berlin State Barracks, which is another road station, proceed to question him further, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, Christian, to talk about our sponsor, which is Rothy's. Rothy's come in an ever-changing array of colors, prints, and patterns, and they're available in a range of styles like sneakers, loafers, points, and more. They launch new colors and patterns every few weeks, and they sell out constantly. Rothy's has quickly grown to the most loved, gotta-have-them brand. It's no surprise they have over 1,000 nearly perfect reviews. They're stylish, sustainable, comfortable, washable, really all in one pair of shoes. They're the perfect flats for life on the go. My wife, Lisa, ordered a pair of the Maritime Navy Points. She remarked how comfortable they were, and she wore them for hours, and how elegant they looked. I agree. And she was very impressed with her Rothy's. And comfort's a big thing with her. Another major bonus with Rothy's is they're fully machine washable. Every time they need a refresh, you can simply toss them in the washing machine. It's like getting a fresh pair every laundry day. Check out all the amazing styles available right now at rothys.com/truemurder. Go to rothys.com/truemurder to get your new favorite flats. Comfort, style, and sustainability. These are the shoes you've been waiting for. Head to rothys.com/truemurder today. Now, we have this Mark Thomas, and as you write, despite one of the detectives thinking that they got their man, that they were close to a confession, this Mark Thomas has serious mental issues and problems. Tell us how police finally get in touch with a woman named Francine Latkin.
Okay, so I hope I get the time correct here. Once this story dropped, it was all over the local papers, etc. That the girls are missing and that they had been found. And at some point, as I recall, they mentioned the existence of a watch that had been found. Now, Francine was working in Atlantic City at the time. And when she had heard over the radio that the girls had been found and one of the girls had blonde hair, she said her blood ran cold because she had met a guy a couple months earlier. I think it was in March while she was on spring break in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So Francine proceeded to go to the police station and say, look, I know one of the girls had blonde hair. When I was in Florida, I met this guy who had the blonde hair. I'm sorry, he had blonde hair. I had blonde hair, and he was obsessed over my hair. One of my friends was interested in him. We went over to this house where he lived with a bunch of guys, a group hippie house, and they had dinner, and the guy kept just fawning over her hair. And she had also noticed at the time that he had a watch, and the watch was interesting because it was encased within a leather, what they call a mod band. A 60s fashion staple, and those thick bands into which the watch face itself is put. So she goes to the police, and the police are asking her questions. And the police say to her, was there anything about him? Was he wearing any jewelry? And she said, no, he wasn't wearing any jewelry. Are you sure he wasn't wearing any jewelry? And she's thinking gold chains, et cetera. And they said, was he wearing a watch? She said, yes, he was wearing a watch. Well, she winds up identifying the same. They show him a picture of the watch. It wasn't this watch. She says, it was that watch. And she remembered the watch specifically because it said it had the word 17 jewels on it, which was apparently some, if you understand watches, and I don't 100%, but that was sort of some sort of notation that was put on the watch faces for depth or chronological, something along those lines. But she matches the watch. They go, and with this evidence, say thank you, and they go to... they put out an APB on this guy. His name is Ronnie Walden. This is the same guy. She said she saw the watch, wearing a watch, and she had, you know, she had the blonde hair. And she had also seen, I should add, that when he was down in Florida, she saw an unprovoked outburst of anger, the guy that really set her off. And he flipped out for no apparent reason. So when she told the police, gave her the information, they said they sent out an APB for this guy. And he turns out being in Colorado. But before we get to Colorado, Francine tells me several years ago that she had talked to a detective, and the detective told her, you know, that they had evidence, and this is in fact the guy that they may have found a half a fingerprint on Susan's car that matched Ronnie Walden. So they go out to Ronnie Walden and visit him in Colorado at the Garfield County Jail, which is where he was being held on auto theft charges. Ronnie was a drifter. I mean, by the time this Francine had met him, he was all over the country, car theft, rap sheet, long, long rap sheet. No violent acts, but a rap sheet. So the Garfield County Police, in response to the APB, notified the New Jersey State Police they have him. Two detectives fly out to interview him. One of them was Detective William Hunter. The other was James Toth, who was head of the polygraph unit. So before they go out there, unbeknownst to them, one of the jailers at the time, a guy named Les Ecker, who I interviewed at length, the day before the police come, or it was maybe in the early morning and they came later in the day, it was a real, real tight proximity. He says he's driving into work, and he learns that one of the, apparently in jail, if there's an alarm, someone is trying to kill themselves, something bad is happening, that the prisoners will wrap their tin cups against the jail bars. Right. And he said that was happening. And he and the other sheriff, Ecker was the undersheriff, I'm forgetting offhand the name of the sheriff himself, go in and cut down Ronnie, who had attempted to kill himself by fashioning a noose made out of bed sheets. He had done it on the top of it. And Mr. Eckers said, look, this guy was blue lining. He said he was about dead when we got him down. This wasn't a joke. So they got him down, and, you know, the strange part is, you know, Eckers says the next thing he knows, the police come in, and Ronnie is there in a neck brace, proceeds to pass the polygraph test, and then, you know, is left or leaves, obviously, or I guess he was in custody for some other reason. He was transported off for federal charges, at least in Garfield County Jail. But it happened to be, and this is what I found stunning, the same jail cell where he had stayed and tried to hang himself was where Ted Bundy had escaped several years later, I think in 1977, on that snowy night before going to Florida State University and killing the four co-eds.
Incredible. You also mentioned that Latkin told the police at some point about an incident involving a knife in the car, which police found interesting, didn't they?
So one of the other things she remembered about Ronnie was a couple weeks early, I guess like a week or so after spring break, she was working in Atlantic City at the Social Security office on, I think, Texas and Pacific Avenues. And her friend, apparently had an involvement of sorts with Ronnie, and Ronnie was coming up, and this friend had gotten Ronnie a job at a store along the boardwalk in Atlantic City called A Man and a Woman. So, when Ronnie comes up and comes to the Social Security office and asks Francina where her friend is, and Francine comes out of the office and says, I have to show you where to park so you don't get towed. He's driving a yellow Dodge muscle car of some sorts, and she gets in the car with them, and something happened to trigger Ronnie, just as some crazy thing triggered him in Fort Lauderdale. And she says a 6-inch about knife, when he slams the brakes, flies out from underneath the seat, and she asks him about it, and he just says it's nothing, or something along those lines, tucks it back under. So that was another piece of, I thought, interesting circumstantial evidence. And the girls were obviously killed with, they said, a paring knife or a pen knife, and the knife that she described wouldn't be inconsistent. Again, I'm not a pathologist or anything along those lines, inconsistent with the knife that was used to kill the girl. So that was another piece of incriminating evidence in addition to the watch that, really lends itself to Ronnie Walden being a person of interest.
Where does Walden go? Where does he move to? And what's his life like? And how does he try to reinvent himself?
Okay, so Walden, I don't know if he really tries to invent himself, because he just, after he is released, he leaves the Garfield County Jail. He does, I guess he's transferred to Denver for a federal rap for auto theft. And from there, he proceeds to go on to a life of crime, really no different than what he had done before. Now, Ronnie was a grifter. I talked to several people. One guy has a great story. He was working as a real estate agent in Colorado when one day this guy appears and says he's a writer for the Atlanta Constitution newspaper. He's looking to buy property. And the guy says, oh, well, why don't you come over and you can stay with me the night? Again, it's the 70s. So he does. And the next day, half of his apartment has been stolen, his fishing rolls and fishing poles, et cetera, and tells the police. And again, they're on the lookout for Ronnie again. He goes in and out of jail, in and out of jail. And ultimately, he has a very, very dark fate because in 1989, coincidentally, within a few months of Bundy's execution, Ronnie is in jail for murdering a man in South Carolina in very strangely coincidental way to how he approached this other guy in Colorado. He was in South Carolina, so he was looking for real estate, and a broker takes him out to a secluded area where Ronnie proceeds to shoot him in the head. During an alleged botched robbery, that's what he said at his trial, but he kills the guy point-blank range, goes to jail, and while in jail, he's just not happy with his conditions. He winds up taking a security guard in the jail hostage, becomes part of a long, drawn-out overnight hostage standoff. Brings his brother in as brothers, says, what's going on, Ronnie? And Ronnie basically is having a breakdown at this point, not inconsistent with these other strange mental episodes. I should also say that Francine had indicated to me, pursuant to her conversation with the state police, that Ronnie did a stint at the Milledgeville, Georgia mental hospital and was apparently schizophrenic. So he was having an episode and winds up, he had smuggled a gun into the prison, and that's what he's using to hold the guard hostage. And he takes the gun and winds up blowing his brains out in 1989. And that's what happens to Ronnie.
Now, as a result of his death, and how does the investigation proceed? And what's the task force that originally was 30? What's its situation now?
So the task force is now whittled down to just a few people. Jack Kreps, a legendary figure, very Dirty Harry-ish, just a 6'4" giant of a man. This guy is just, you talk to the police officers, the detectives that knew him, and they all just laugh because they said the guy was bigger than life. One guy referred to him as just being, his words were, stone cold fucking nuts. I mean, they say this guy was just really, he was just do whatever he could do. And it was down to him and another guy, Harvey Burns, even George Dixon, Detective Patterson's, that they were, they went on to work other cases when it went cold. So it was down to Kreps and this other guy, and they really proceeded to sort of circle back and look at what they had. And they went, you know, they went back to Mark Thomas. The crazy thing about Ronnie Walden is that, you know, even when Francine had brought up the conversation about him and what she had learned back in 1969 to the New Jersey State Police later and said, look, do you guys remember him? This Ronnie Walden, the detective with whom she spoke, said they didn't have any information on the guy. And what struck me as odd is that Ronnie was dead by the time they had this conversation. And he apparently didn't know that. So I don't know how, after Ronnie was freed, I guess is for lack of a better term, or no longer became a person of interest to the police after he passed the polygraph test in Colorado. How they didn't know that is sort of interesting. But getting back to your point, yeah, so it became these two guys who then went back to Pennsylvania and started to reinvestigate this kid over there, you know, to see what they could find, basically, because I don't really think they had anyone else to pursue. They did travel across the country. They went to San Francisco, you know, and did all sorts of investigation around the country. Any remote connection, you know, the police really did investigate. They just didn't have anything, Dan, and that was the problem.
In 1982, in October, you talk about representatives of the Major Crime Unit heard from an author, or heard from, pardon me, from authorities in Florida that a notorious criminal, a young man, that they had wanted to question 2 years earlier, had made a stunning revelation.
Yeah.
Tell us about Gerald Eugene Stano, and what does that
say? Gerald Eugene Stano was one of the most notorious serial killers in history of the United States, the world. He killed about 30 women down there. He was actually from the Philadelphia area. Although he had spent a lot of his time growing up in Florida, from the point he was born, he was adopted. His parents, he's adopted in New York, and his father was a tobacco company executive, moved his family to Bluebell, Pennsylvania in Montgomery County at the time. Later he went to Florida and he killed all these women. And he started making these confessions to Detective Crow at the Daytona Beach Police Department, where he was had already been arrested for murder of someone down there. And Crow started getting all these confessions from him. And one of the things he alluded to was an involvement in these killings. So that's how he came about. And it turned out, well, you know, the state police did go down there, I guess, to try to question him back in 1980, and he wouldn't cooperate. They then went again in 82 after more of these confessions started coming out, and Detective Crow alerted them, look, you know, this guy's talking. And they sent two detectives down there to interrogate him about the Garden State Parkway murders and his admissions to them and so forth. And, you know, they were never able, I was understanding, to, according to Detective Tom Kinzer, to ultimately clear him. But nevertheless, they weren't really persuaded by what they had learned during their trip down there to believe that he was responsible for the murders. But, you know, that's what I find interesting, Dan, and this is one of the things that always circles back to, you know, it's now 2020. These took place in 1969. Gerald Stano, who for a time, this is again one of the strange coincidences, lived next to Ted Bundy on death row. You know, why did the police, or have the police, again, these are the answers I'd like to see as a result of this book. You know, was he one of the thousands that were interviewed back in 1969? We don't know that. All we know is that obviously the police know that he was here in 1969. Okay. But, you know, was he one of the kids investigated and questioned by the state police? Because I think you'd have to agree that would go a long way towards solving this thing if Stano was in fact questioned back then by state police, and then, you know, later went on to become a serial killer. He was living in Philadelphia at the time. He was close to it. He admitted to the murders, and he was known to be a serial killer later. I would think he is worth further investigation as far as the dated files are concerned.
Yes, certainly. You also write about the controversy with Sergeant Crow, or is what a couple detectives thought, and they really believed and even tested him in their minds to prove that he had an extraordinary bias in this questioning. Tell us about about the specifics of what Stano said regarding these Parkway murders.
Well, apparently the confession, you know, that's in my book, the Garden State Parkway Murders, was read to me over the phone by Detective Crow of what Stano had told him. He was off in time and place as far as it wasn't quite that specific. But there was that when the two detectives from New Jersey went to interview him, one of the detectives told me that one of the reasons he didn't believe Stano's confession was he was interviewing. He just didn't know enough about what had happened. They had apprised him of the holdbacks. He was all over the place, and they just didn't feel that he had did it. And one of the detectives, again, this is his version of events, said that he had told the detective Crow down there that, you know, one of the girls was wearing a blue shirt or whatever the case may be. And he said when they returned from lunch and began re-interviewing Stano about the Garden State Parkway murders, he indicated that, they said, was she wearing a blue shirt? He said, yes. So, see, he determined that, you know, maybe that Stano was being fed answers. And that a lot of these confessions. Now, Stano, who was executed, I think, in 1994 or 97, I may have that day wrong, had always said that a lot of his confessions were, as a result of undue pressure by the detectives and so forth. So he had always held steadfast to the fact that he didn't kill all these girls and whatnot. But, you know, I had talked to, interviewed for the book, other detectives down there, and one guy told me, look, this guy killed every single girl that he was ever accused of killing. So don't think for a second that that these confessions, however they were obtained, were somehow false. This guy was guilty as sin.
What consistencies or inconsistencies in terms of the signature regarding the woods and the roadside abduction? Tell us if there was any consistencies or inconsistencies with Stano's MO and signature.
Oh, absolutely. So Stano would typically select women, although he also had prostitutes that he had slain, sadly. There were also a couple of young women who fit the profile of the blonde hair and so forth, college girls. They were wearing blue dresses, but he would consistently conceal the bodies under leaves and sticks. And he would also sometimes pile the clothing nearby them, almost methodically. And I guess one of the reasons the police in New Jersey went down to visit Stano to begin with, notwithstanding his confessions, was because of the consistency of the crime scenes. I mean, you know that there's a whole other vein of serial killers, but as far as signatures are concerned, and the like, there's always a consistency, not always, but most of the time, a consistency to their body of work. They'll do certain things like leave sticks or bury them in sticks and leaves, and everything. His past murders were very consistent with how these two girls, Susan and Elizabeth, were found in the park. He would also use his car to apprehend victims. So there was always that possibility with the circumstances of the park and murders of girls found on the side of the road that Stano could, in fact, have done these, given his history of covering them with sticks, getting college-age girls, using a car, and, of course, his proximity to the crime scene.
We talked about it in the introduction, the most infamous and most fascinating serial killer, Ted Bundy. As we mentioned, he had adjacent cells in Florida State Penitentiary with Stano. Tell us what Bundy had said and to who, and what specifically authorities thought that Bundy might be of interest in this, and your investigation on Bundy's whereabouts and potential as a suspect.
Okay, so in, again, as I may have mentioned earlier, in 1986, Bundy had spoken to a gentleman who has since passed away named Art Norman. He was a psychologist for the defense team. It was, I think, Halloween 1986. Bill Kelly, an Ocean City historian, had interviewed Art Norman just after Bundy was executed in 1989, asking his recollection of the 1986 conversation with Bundy. Art Norman had withheld what Bundy told him because of, he didn't want to, you know, violate whatever the Hippocratic Oath was at the time. But right after Bundy was executed, Art Norman comes forth and says, in 1986, Bundy told me, again, Bundy speaking in the third person, out of nowhere, said, well, it was, you know, in spring of 1969, he, meaning Bundy, didn't have a lot to do. He wound up going down to a place they call the Jersey Shore. He wound up picking up a couple of girls on the beach, and it wound up being the first time that he did it. It was something he was never able to go back from. It was just a traumatic event that shocked him for years. Now, Art Norman certainly admitted after this became public that Bundy never specifically stated in the first person, I killed Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry. But what he had indicated, it's just so strikingly coincidental. Now, when he called the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office and the state police and told them what Bundy had said to him in 86, like, look, two girls were killed on Memorial Day weekend. Okay. They were at the Jersey Shore. Bundy is here saying, I was, you know, he went to Ocean City. It was late spring. And all of these factors were checked off. Bundy was, in fact, staying with an aunt in the spring of 1969. He was enrolled at the School of General Studies at Temple University. He was living with an aunt. So all these things added up. I also found out that Bundy had a far greater history, and this has never been reported before, to Ocean City, New Jersey. He had, according to the relative, that I interviewed at length, who was the same person with whom he lived in Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania, 1969, while attending Temple University, that he had made several trips with his family to Ocean City, New Jersey. In fact, there was a family member who had a house down there. So he had, to the extent that serial killers, Dan, strike in a familiar area with which they are comfortable, he certainly had ample opportunity over the years, if he in fact did this, to scope out where he would kill these two women.
Was there, again, an MO, signature, consistencies with this crime and Bundy's crimes?
Not overly. Bundy would typically, his whole MO was he would find a woman, and as certainly you know, this has been portrayed again and again, he would use the fake arm cast. He would portray himself as a needy person in need of help, distress, you know, walk to a car. He'd want to be seen by someone as needing help. They'd come, and then he would typically club them over the head, put them in the car, take them and then murder them, decapitate them, et cetera, et cetera. So the MOs did not match up. However, deliberate stranger Mr. Larson believed, and this is what he said to Larry Kelly in 1993, that this would have been Ted Bundy's, he believed, as one of Bundy's first biographers, the Jersey Shore murders were Bundy's first unplanned crime. And that he sharpened his MOs later. But he believed that the Garden State Parkway murders were, in fact, something that Bundy, in fact, had done. That was his opinion. He passed away a few years ago. I was never able to interview him, but he last went on record believing that Bundy had killed Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry on Memorial Day 1969.
Interesting, it went against his MO later unless he totally revised it in terms of attacking two women at one time. Let's get to, as I mentioned before to you, I looked at this Walden character, and the interesting thing that we maybe glossed over a little bit was that there was a partial print on the vehicle, and that was a match, but not enough to say that that was a conclusive thing in court. But a partial print match is very important. You say that some people would look at this as, well, he was a thief, then why wouldn't he steal? How about the idea that this could have been a confrontation over the vehicle itself, just very much or similar to the other struggle he had, which led to murder?
Well, it could have been, but here's the thing. Again, this lends itself to the fascination. Each time you think you have a particular suspect, you have the circumstantial evidence.
Sure.
You've got the Ronnie Walden. You've got the Bundy admitting, and he was at the beach. You've got Gerald Stano, okay, admitting to the murders. You always have these strange things that go against it. And what happened with Ronnie was one of the things that Francine had told me, and then she had also told the police, and this also made the press in 1969, is one, in addition to him being down there and she telling the police that he had a watch, he had left Atlantic City, according to Francine, immediately after the murders had occurred. And that's one of the things, in addition to the watch, that had prompted her to notify the police. He had left immediately thereafter. He was driving, they said, when they found him in Colorado with a car that he had stolen from New Jersey, which was, I think, a yellow Dodge with a trailer with a motorcycle attached to it. So if he had a car, Dan, again, you start to think, what would he be doing? He wouldn't be hitchhiking if he had left town in a car that he had stolen. And why would he be pulling two girls over to the side of the road? And if he was doing that to rob him, why wouldn't he have robbed them after killing them, if this was consistent with his murder of a guy named George Wells in South Carolina in 1984? Why wouldn't he have robbed Susan and Elizabeth? And when you think of these girls being stabbed to death, one of them, stripped. These things are consistent, and this is what I've attempted to do in the book as well, with the makings of a serial killer. So my, although Ronnie is a very viable suspect, again, you have to ask yourself, would he have, is MO consistent with how these girls were found? And given the fact that he had left town allegedly in a trailer, with a motorcycle attached, that he had stolen from the owner of a man and a woman, by the way, right as he left town after the murders. Those things don't match, but everything else does. So I really think it comes back to Ronnie Walden needing to be further investigated at this point, at least his file, by the state police.
How significant is that partial print match, though?
I know.
Regardless
of
admissibility.
Well, Francine had sent me her notes that she kept from 1969, her handwritten notes. Okay, and the guy had told her that she was never able to specifically identify the officer with whom she spoke, with everything else she had written down, and I saw. So they had half a print, and they said that they were, quote, 99 and I think 0.25% certain that he was the guy, and she remembered that phrase because that's what Ivory Soap used to use as their jingle, that were 99% and everyone percent pure. So that's how she remembered. As far as the print, I don't know, because, again, when she told, this detective with the state police years later, in like 2003, 4, 5, 6, something along those lines, before she had sent her notes to me in my office, she had talked to the guy, and the guy said, apparently said, I don't know anything about this Ronnie Walden or anything along those lines. So I don't know if he was, what the extent of is with their state police file, the investigative reports. Was he just not considered a person of interest after he had passed the lie detector test? I just don't know. But again, to this day, given the fact that we have the watch identified as belonging to him, we have his past mental health, we have the fact that he murdered someone in South Carolina, all these things. You know, we have the alleged fingerprints. We've got the 99.5%. So many of these things add up to be Ronnie Walden being a viable person of interest. Fascinating.
Did Walden fit the description from Albert Hickey in any way? The 5'7" to 5'9"?
No. Ronnie was He was a 6'2" former high school athlete. I interviewed several people from his hometown of Cairo, Georgia, which also produced Jackie Robinson, a number of people. Quiet, southern, gothic type place. And they all, you know, all the women I spoke with said he was, you know, a dangerous guy. There was always something about him. Women, I think, are born with this intuitive sense of evil in people. And they all said there was something about him, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they said that one of the reasons he went down the wrong path is because he always wanted a scholarship to Florida State University to play football. And never got it. He got a, you know, financial grant and aid. And one of his former girlfriends told me that she believed him not getting that scholarship, and he had also I think he had had a kid that at 18 that died in childbirth. So a couple of these factors sent him down the wrong path. But physically, the answer to your question is no, he was not seen wearing a turtleneck. Again, it wasn't, but Francine was the only one who, and she had done it after the fact. So Ronnie's sort of name arose after the Albert Hickey thing was mentioned, but no, he was never seen wearing a yellow turtleneck. And physically, the guy that was seen at the circle, Summers Point Traffic Circle, was like 5'9", shaggy hair, dark hair, not tall, 6'2", and blonde like Ronnie was.
There was a legion of detectives that retired, and other detectives took up the mantle in this investigation. And you write of some detectives wedded to their earlier decisions as to who killed Elizabeth and Susan that day, that weekend.
Yeah, the detectives are pretty much all over the place. They were never really able to decide who did it. I don't know if there was ever any collective consensus on who they believe did it. And that's the frustrating part. You talk to these gentlemen, at least the retired ones. You know, the present day ones aren't very disclosive for legal concerns. You talk to the other ones and you ask them, well, who do you think did it? Well, you know, it could have been Bundy. They're very, you can just hear the anguish in their voice as though they are haunted because this is the one that got away. And in fact, one of the state police detectives that I interviewed, he had a very interesting quote. He said, you know, so many of these guys would have given a piece of their pension, you know, to find out who did this. And if you know anything about state police pensions in New Jersey, they're pretty substantial. So it's fascinating how, and even when you talk, you know, Detective Dix, who I interviewed at length, Detective Krebs before he passed away. These guys are so, they just resonated sincerity and how much they wanted to see this thing get resolved. But it all came back to, at least they said, the 3 days. And one guy said to me, if we could just have those 3 days back. Again, the 3 days being between the time the girls were found and the car was reported. So very, very, very tragic.
It's very tragic, too, that I think, anyway, coming from reading this, that the scapegoating of Detective or Patrolman Steer. Just tell us briefly about that.
Well, yeah, he was brought up on, I guess the state police have a sort of military-esque hierarchical structure as far as disciplining, and in addition to, you know, anointing people, captain, lieutenant, what have you. So he was court-martialed, brought in court-martial proceeding. Ironically or coincidentally, his attorney was Patrick McGann. Patrick McGann is, I believe, the uncle of former White House counsel, Don McGann. Which is pretty interesting connection there. But, yeah, Patrick McGann tried the case, and Stir was a state scapegoat because they wanted to have someone to pin this on, and he was the guy. But ultimately, his rank was restored, and he did have his name, his good name, brought back, you know, years later after this all went down, he got a promotion. I never had a chance to interview him. He did pass away some long time ago. But it's a shame that this happened to him, because my point about Lou Sturr has always been this. And let's say he pulls over down to the side of the road, and he sees the car. You know, pretty much, according to the coroner's report, the girls were dead by this time. So let's say he goes in and he finds the bodies, you know, rather than the highway worker. It wouldn't have brought them back. It still happened. The people were long, you know, whoever did this had long since, you know, disappeared. So I always felt that Sturr was a little bit unfairly blamed in it. But again, it is what it is. It was an unfortunate mark, a blemish, if you will, on his career.
It just seemed very interesting. We always talk about the pressure for these police to be able to solve this, but there really is a pressure, and these guys take it upon their shoulders. Like you say, these guys can't let these cases go. It stays with them. And so it's tragic to see a patrolman that looks like he was, you know, an innocent mistake or oversight, whatever you want to call it, but certainly not negligence, and certainly wouldn't have changed the outcome of the investigation, seemingly. So it is just the overall extent of the brunt that the police take, and prosecutors, but especially detectives, in these cold case mysteries like this.
And you know, another thing is, I can identify with the obsession. You know, I've been. Mm-hmm. I've been extensively researching the case in the past 10 years, which comprises the Garden State Parkway murders, don't forget, I have been interested in the case since about, you know, 2000, as far as really doing a deep dive into it. You know, the first book took several years to write, and that was The Origins of Infamy. So I identify, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about this case and what happened. I mean, and I'm not a detective, but I can completely identify with the passion they have, and that obsession to see some sort of closure with this. And that's just what we don't have at this point. You know, as I said, I keep returning to, you know, we really need to do a re-review of the case, given what I've disclosed in this book. You know, that many of the present day detectives that I spoke with, I should say present day, the detectives that I've spoken with that worked on the case, you know, when I begin to tell them what I know about it, you know, in a preface to my attempt to interview them, they say, wow, you know more about the case than I do. So, you know, I can definitely identify, I say that just really to illuminate the point that I can identify with the passion and the obsession that people like, you know, Jack Kreps and George Dix and these guys had with the case, and it really haunted them for the rest of their lives.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you, Christian, for coming on and talking about the Garden State Parkway murders, a cold case mystery. This is a Wild Blue Press release. If people want to find out more information or take a look at, do you have a Facebook page, website? Tell us how they might take a look at this work.
They can order the book on Amazon. I believe that it's also for sale at Sun Rose Words and Music on Asbury Avenue in Ocean City. Again, on the Wild Blue Press site, wildbluepress.com, you can find my biography where I go into a little bit of the book, how I came to get interested in this case so fervently. You could order it from there and learn more about it. I also blogged about a little bit about Ted Bundy as well, some interesting and heretofore unknown facts about him, which I think were sort of opposite of some of the things that are commonly understood about him. So you could go to Wild Blue Press website, my biography on there, order through there or Amazon or at Sun Rose Words and Music.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, Christian Barth, for the Garden State Parkway murders. You have a great night.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.